Paperback Writers.
Okay, welcome to Coffee Break. I'm Neil Damgard. I'm wired up because I've already had two cups of coffee today. And I'm here with Bob Perrin and Gabrielle Perrin in the catacombs of our Tiverton studio for the podcast on Coffee Break. Glad you've joined us.
Paperback Writer!
So, Bob and Gabrielle, welcome to the show.
Thank
you. And we want to talk today about, is this a lighthearted topic or is this a heavy topic?
I would say lighthearted. She might say heavy.
Okay. I was going to say heavy, actually.
Can I make a correction?
A correction?
Last
this is our podcast.
Yes. No.
Not my podcast. I didn't say that anyway. Yes, last
it week. I mentioned that it was the 76th podcast, mm-hmm. and that is incorrect.
Right.
This week, the one we're recording now, is the 79th.
79th. Wow. Is there anything meaningful with the word, the number 79? Is that meaningful?
No.
That's the year I went to seminary.
It's just impressive.
It is? Oh, is it? Oh, okay, good. All right, I'll take that. So we're going to do either a lighthearted or a heavy topic. It depends on who we're asking in the audience. And it's the subject of the writing of a book writing. And I have written one book. And Gabrielle here has written...
Completed and published one, but I have probably about 12 abandoned manuscripts somewhere up there that have been completed.
Wow, that's impressive. I believe they use the word prolific to describe that.
I wrote a book.
You wrote a book?
And actually someone wrote a song about me writing a book.
And what is that song, pray tell?
Who wrote the book of love?
Oh, yes. Right. Okay, that's right.
I wrote the book of love.
I remember that song. Yeah.
Yeah, love, people don't have to wonder
love,
anymore.
Love, la, 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 la. The book of love. Okay, there we go. The book of love. All right, so Bob wrote the book
that's
of love.
That's the game of love.
The game of love. Sorry. The game of love?
Who wrote the book of love? That I'm going back further than you did.
Okay, that's true. Yeah, you're back in the 50s.
I'm back. You were in the 60s. That's right. Where else would you be?
Yeah, I know. That's right. I know. There is no other decade. Okay, so we're going to talk about writing books today. It's a subject of interest. I actually would like to write another book than the one I have done. 3 years ago, I published a book on the history of Dartmouth Bible Church, which I immensely enjoyed doing. I didn't have a clue how to do it. I learned a lot in the process. Did you learn anything from the first book that you published, Gabrielle?
Well, yeah, I would say I've learned that it's good to be... to revise and stuff, but don't be a perfectionist because otherwise it's never going to get done. It took me, I want to say, 4 years of editing before I actually published my book.
My goodness, 4 years of editing.
Yeah, I don't want
to
do that.
And you
again.
Were still sane? You got to the end of that process?
Yeah, somehow I managed.
Well, editing is a necessary part of, I mean, if you're serious about writing a book. But there's some more basic questions before we get to the minutiae of actually doing it. Do you think that everybody should write a book?
No.
Or why doesn't everybody write a book?
Because they don't have talent.
Absolutely.
Oh, you have to have talent.
Absolutely not. No one's going to listen to you if you don't sound intelligent or have something important to say.
Ah, important to say. So that would rule out the significance of all fiction then, right?
Well, I don't think so. I think fiction has a lot to help us with.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do. I think that even the fantasy genre exists to help people in some ways.
Interesting. Not just for me to sort of barf up whatever it is, angst I've got going on inside of me, so I write this novel about these guys and... state of Rhode Island that imagine they're supposed to be more significant than they actually are, so they start a radio show, and lo and behold, I'm making this up.
Don't like where that's going.
Sounds eerily familiar.
Yeah, so not everybody should even try, you would say. This isn't just for everybody to do.
I would say everyone should try. Doesn't mean everybody will succeed. There's a quote from a movie... called Ratatouille, actually. It says, anyone can cook. But the whole message in the movie was, are you really good at it?
Hmm. That's interesting. And, of course, there's different kinds of books that one might try to write. You are a fiction writer, am I right?
Yep, I do specifically epic fantasy and like romantic historical fiction.
Okay, and the book I wrote is a history book, Everybody Writes, by, who is that?
Anne Handley.
And what's the thesis of that book?
That everybody writes.
One way or another?
Everybody writes. And actually, when we were talking about not everybody should write, I just remembered I have this book over here, Everybody Writes. And we do all write. We write notes to ourselves. We write
emails.
We write things to other people. And if you're going to write, you should do it well.
Yeah, yeah. Lately, I have been doing a lot of reflecting on Facebook. Yeah. And I think I do this primarily to entertain myself, or not entertain, but to get out of my head onto some kind of a screen what I'm thinking about and organize the thoughts a little bit and then go back and revise. I constantly revise my own Facebook posts.
Same here. Yeah. I always
think,
I could have made that better.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So that's an interesting premise, Bob, that everybody writes or communicates in one way or another with words. So, I'm not sure that everybody, certainly everybody won't write. Everyone won't even try. Most people won't even try. But I thought about writing a book for years before I finally hit on this idea of writing the history of our church. Our church had hit its 50th year. I had been there 30 years. I thought, if anybody's going to write the history, write down a lot of this lore of the little church that we're part of, it ought to be me. I think I can do it, therefore I should do it. That was the calculus that drove me to do that.
And it's an invaluable service, because when the church celebrates its 100th year anniversary, and someone writes a book on the 100th year anniversary of the Dartmouth Bible Church, they'll have a lot of the groundwork for the first 50 years already there.
They will.
Exactly.
And that was a sort of a side motivation, is to realize that what I collect and record, of course, I had to filter. That was an interesting part of writing a historical book, is you can't write everything, and you don't want to write everything because there's some darkness back there that you don't really necessarily want to preserve for posterity. They don't need to know everything. But so you learn how to, with all the data on the table that you collect, you learn how to filter what you want to say and you don't. That's in historical work. I would like to write a book. I think I'm supposed to write a book about my father. I've shared this before on the podcast here. Because, first of all, I know a lot about him. I think a lot that he did thought about to me, not just because I'm his son. Not all sons are particularly interested in their fathers. But I am, and I was an only child, and so he was a major part of my psyche, and there are a lot of interesting stories. I found not too long ago a folder in his stuff of essays that he wrote when he was 18. He's a freshman in college. It's 1933. FDR has just been inaugurated. Adolf Hitler has just been made Chancellor Führer. But to put it in context, and I have all these essays of this 18-year-old young man, what he's writing for freshman English in his college. He went to college, and they're fascinating to me.
Wow.
So plus all of his war stuff that I've got, and afterwards, and anyway, I feel, and both my daughters feel like I should. I need to collect this and make a book out of that. But
but
not everybody should write a book. Not everybody can. Not everybody. Most people wouldn't want to. They, like you said, Gabrielle, they maybe wouldn't have something to say. But if you have something to say, and you can communicate it, I think it's worth trying.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
And what would stop someone from writing a book?
Probably insecurity. They don't think they could do it.
Or people not being encouraging enough.
Yeah, so if they're in a negative environment, of course, the history of literature is filled with famous writers that got all kinds of negative flack.
Rebels and outcasts, a lot of them.
Yeah, I think Poe is an interesting guy.
Oh, I love his work.
I can't stand his work. Because it's so incredibly depressing. You know, the pit and the pendulum, give me a break. What kind of a mind thinks about that? But if I remember a little bit of history of literature here, I don't think he got a lot of encouragement to write. I think he was just a dark soul that vented his stuff through the stories that he wrote. And so not everybody gets encouragement, and that might be a detraction, is there isn't an environment that gets you to write it. Another thing that I learned is that it's expensive.
Yeah.
My book cost me about $7,000. Wow. And I really had no expectations. Of course, the publisher's leaning on you to market this book and do all these things, and you know, and I'm just not. I can't sell anything. I'm the world's worst salesman. So I tried that, and I thought, this is stupid. I already know I'm not a good salesman. Mm. So I think I sold about 80 books. And it cost me $7,000 to do it. And I didn't care about that. Right. I didn't do it to make money. I did it to...
For the love of it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't even know, Gabrielle, that it was the love of it. I hadn't done it before, but then I loved it.
Yeah.
It took me about a year and a half. And as I say, I learned an immense amount working with a good publisher. My publisher was Westbow Press, which is the self-publishing arm of Thomas Nelson. It's a first-rate route and very expensive to me too, but they were fabulously helpful. Mm. You know.
Yeah, so, I don't want to change the subject here, but they're closely correlating with this. First of all, money is a good motivator. Mm. I mean, if you want to write a book and somebody's offering you money for it in advance,
yeah,
or you get
a
contract.
There's a book deal on the table.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very good motivator.
Yeah, I could get real motivated then.
But, you know, I did a documentary a couple years ago on Baptist Temple Church in
Fall
River.
Yeah, I've seen it, the video.
Right, and my whole family was involved in it. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of research. I was crawling up in
attics. Was it fun?
It was fun to do. Now, that...
I remember the graveyard hunt. We were looking for people. That was really cool.
Yeah, we went to a graveyard. I spent an afternoon up in an attic in an old church in Fall River.
Is there a sequel coming?
No.
The Return of the Empire?
No,
or
no.
Something?
That was a labor of love. And I didn't even, you know, I didn't even go to the church at the time. It was a church I was brought up in.
But you did it because you wanted to.
We did it because I wanted to. I did it for my father. I did it for the pastor who was there at the time, which was Robert Chapman.
I knew him.
Yeah,
I knew Pastor Chapman. Yeah.
So
I have a copy of that. Somehow or other, you gave me one, or I bought one, or somewhere along the line. Yeah, and it was very well done.
Yeah, thank you. And that was so early in my video making career that, that was a labor of love. So it's going to be something you want to do and you're motivated to do, and people are encouraging you to do it, because I had a lot of encouragement.
So there has to be an idea before you write a book, and then enough information to work with to develop that idea. So, if, for instance, if you've written, what did you say, romance?
A historical romance.
Historical romance.
Napoleonic War era.
So you don't want to be an idiot about that era then, right?
Absolutely not.
So you've got to know about what's involved with 200 years ago, basically, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that was a lot of fun, but it was a lot of work. Luckily, I already had a passion for the Napoleonic era, so I had somewhat of a foundation, but it was a naval novel, so I had to go back and study the Royal Navy back when Napoleon started the war.
Which brings to mind Master and Commander,
the
movie.
Oh, I love that movie. Horatio Hornblower is my... I love Horatio Hornblower.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Who's the author of Horatio Hornblower?
C.S. Forrester.
C.S. Forrester, who also wrote a book about Bismarck, too, by the way. Yeah.
Sink to Bismarck? Something?
Yeah. Well, the book wasn't called that. The movie was Sink to Bismarck, that was based on the last 9 days of Bismarck, is what Forrester's... So you had to learn naval history, the Royal Navy specifically, to get you into that time.
Exactly.
So that, and then you learn a lot, and then you're able to construct a storyline.
Yeah. And she also drank a lot of grog during that time.
Yeah. And grog in Tiverton is hard to come by. I think you got to cross over into Fall River to get grog these days.
Yeah, I just get some swamp water in the back.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let it sit around in a pot for a while.
Listen to a lot of sea shanties.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Well, that is very interesting, Gabrielle. So another question, basic sort of fundamental question. How long should a book be? Is that something that you think before you would write a book?
I do. I know I do.
So you say to yourself 287 pages?
Well, usually I think in terms of 50s, like 200, 250, 300, 350. I think it depends on the type of novel you want to write. I know that there are actually publishing guidelines for different type genres of books. Like, they tell you so many words is a good bracket. So I try to stick with that.
Which is a weird way to think, because we don't normally think in terms of, you know, if you get a letter in the mail, you go, hey, this is a 300-word letter here.
Exactly.
We don't think that way, but yes, right. Yeah, 5,000 words or something is a section, maybe, or, you know, I'm reading a book right now that's 800 pages, and it's volume two. Volume one was 800 pages. And it really isn't a book. It's a transcript. It's the Nixon tapes. But it's a serious piece of historical writing. And I'm fascinated. I'm endlessly fascinated. But these are big, long, hairy books.
Yeah.
And there's a book that was, I don't know why I'm thinking about this book, but there was a fellow in New Bedford. It was an interesting man named Daniel Ricketson. Mm-hmm. And Ricketson, as a teenager, went around, and this is in the 1840s, 1850s, he goes around and collects, he's like 17, collects stories from local residents of New Bedford of the old days, which means the Revolutionary War, the Napoleonic
wow.
era. And he goes around and he just collects little stories. So he goes over to old Bob Perrin's house and he says, Bob, tell us a story about the old days. And Bob cranks out a little yarn here and he writes it down and then he publishes it in the newspaper. And it becomes like a weekly serial in the New Bedford, whatever it was called, the newspaper at that time. So he's a writing young man, and then he decides later, you know what, I need to collect all of these stories into the history of New Bedford.
Wow.
And he does it. And the book is 3-4 inches thick. It's this big, huge book, and it's absolutely, and if you could look at it on, it's free online, you know, it's a, what do you call it, a, you know, it's a public domain ebook now, and you can look at this thing and
it
starts with this guy having an interest in the stories that residents tell. He tells a story of when the British soldiers invaded New Bedford.
Oh, wow.
It happened twice, actually.
It's crazy to think anything ever interesting happened around here, right?
Oh, man. And because of Ricketson, all you can do is look at his stuff, and it's fascinating. Mm. This old lady, the British troops, the Redcoats, are moving up the street, and they're burning houses and businesses, and this old lady goes out on her front porch and throws a pumpkin at them. And they're
That's
so amused
cool.
at that. Whoa, jump out of the way here. Jump back, Jack. You know, there's a pumpkin flying at us here. And they're so amused at that they don't burn her house.
Wow.
Ricketson gets this story from somewhere and writes it down. It's just, yeah. So there's a lot of things that come into the genesis of a book. The length of a book, I had no idea how long my book would be. It ended up being just exactly 200 pages, which isn't very long at all, really. But you get to the end of the process and you say, I think you're done. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
You realize to go further would be, I don't know, artificial or something. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
no, I understand.
Some books
are
too long.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
I don't know. Have you ever, Bob, have you ever read, maybe Gabrielle, have you ever read any Tom Clancy?
Oh, yeah.
Familiar with Tom Clancy.
Yeah.
Do you find it a bit toilsome at times to read 50 pages of nuclear physics before they explode the device, you know? Oh, yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
But I love that kind of detail.
He's more of a Clive Cussler guy.
Clive Cussler, yeah. I probably wouldn't have brought that up because, you know, he's have you read Clive
Cussler? Never. You see his books everywhere. Read a Clive. Not one single one.
What do you want to call him? Not a hack, but he just publishes stuff.
Cranks them out.
And I don't even know if he writes
formulaic.
Them. Yeah, but they're fun.
Are they?
Fun.
Yeah.
It's underwater spy stuff.
I love
treasure hunt stuff.
Yeah. I love espionage
and story,
all of that.
You know,
yeah.
The characters all kind of melt together from different stories because it's basically the same thing told in a different
way.
Yeah.
Like a James Bond almost.
Yeah, but it's fun. It's fun, and I love underwater stuff and
spy
stuff and all that. So
yeah, I love that those themes also, and some people can just endlessly imagine these storylines. So here's another stupid basic question: are all books created equal?
No.
I wouldn't.
All
say
men
so.
Are created equal.
So
but not books.
I noticed that bookstores seem to be on the wane.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to find bookstores like you used to be able, and it's probably because of online purchasing now.
Right.
But there are bookstores still, and I'll go into a Barnes & Noble or something, and I notice they'll have, Barnes & Noble in particular, will have right inside the door all the cheap stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily bad stuff. It can be some very good stuff that's there for $3 or $4 or something, you know. But then the really good stuff, the frontline stuff, no, that's inside the thing, you know. And that's all about marketing, I guess.
Mm.
You know.
When we lived up in New Hampshire, there was, we were out of boonies, but in the town that was about, you know, 40 miles away. No, it wasn't that far away, but...
It was pretty far.
It was far away. It took us about a half hour to get there. There was a Borders bookstore. Now, Borders, are they still around, or did they close up Borders bookstore?
I think they closed.
There was a Borders bookstore here in the town of Wareham, which has closed.
Yeah, I don't know if they all closed.
I regret that. But Borders was fun.
But I understood Barnes & Noble was, there was a little... point in time there when they were kind of iffy as whether or not they're brick and mortar.
Is that right? Yeah, I don't know.
But apparently they're staying open.
Yeah, I think it's partly due to the Nook.
I used to love stores that were just one of a kind, mom or dad's.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
And there's a bookstore down on Route 6. It's got that English Tutor. Baxter, is it Baxter Books? Or?
I don't know. Baker Books.
Baker Books.
It's gone out of business now.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yeah. Aww. Yeah. The folks that owned it just ended the business. Yeah. They kept it going. They moved locations, and they kept it going a little bit for a while, and then they've retired, I think, now. Mm-hmm. But then there will be a bookstore like in the Vanity Fair Outlet Mall.
Right.
Warehouse.
Yeah. I go there all the time.
All remainders.
Yeah.
They're all remainders, yeah.
Yeah, and there's some good stuff in there, too. So, Gabrielle, let me ask you another question. So this is another, I'm a reductionist, I guess. I get down to the really simple ideas to talk about. So if you're writing a novel and you're writing a story, you imagine how this story is going to spin out in the book, how do you decide what to name the characters? Have you thought about that? There must be some you don't just say, okay, I'm going to go with Stephen or... randomly or something, do you? Do you actually think about the name?
I do, but I don't think that when I'm thinking about it, it's for any particular reason. I think it just has to sound right with the last name I picked or if I like the name.
Give me a name from your book.
The one I'm working on now, Nelia Bowman. She's a tavern lady.
What's the first name?
Nelia.
Nelia. Mm-hmm. Spelled?
N-E-L-I-A.
Interesting. Bowman. Yeah. A tavern owner, drawing a cold one for the customers. Yeah. Interesting.
As I said, historical.
Is Nelia a real name?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, interesting.
It's the nickname Nelly comes from that name. Actually, that's the whole name.
So, give us a male name that you might use. That's not necessarily have used, but would use. That you like a name that looks good on print.
I came up with one called Vincent Keegan. He's a captain.
Yeah, Vincent. I never knew a Vincent I liked. That's interesting.
I use a lot of old-fashioned names.
Yeah, sure. Well, you're writing for an era that, and an awful lot of names have been lost that nobody uses anymore. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I know a Vincent that I liked. You liked him, too, if you knew him. Vincent Griffiths,
I knew Vince Griffiths.
And now Griffiths. He's with the Lord now, and he was a great guy. So I wanted to correct you in case anybody heard that.
All right, that's true. That's a Vince I would like, too. That is true. Yeah. All right, so a lot of other things to think about here in the idea of writing a book. And here's another question. If you were going to write a book, Bob, let's say you got an idea, and it burned in your mind, and you said, I've got to write about this. This is just an inspirational little fireball going on there. I've got to deal with this. Would you start, after you did your thinking through and maybe a little bit of research, would you sit down with a pad and pencil? Or would you immediately just go to the computer and start typing?
I'd go with a pad and pencil.
Would you?
Yeah. Mm.
And why would that be, you old guy, you?
Because I probably would be doing it
someplace where I wouldn't have my computer.
Yeah.
My ideas, when they start to germinate, I've tried, I actually have a little voice recorder that I carry around with me, and I've tried recording things on there just so I can remember stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And half the time I forget to bring it with me, so. Mm.
It doesn't work for you.
Yeah, yeah. Just notes. Just
I guess you're not
down,
a journalist by trade then, are you? Yeah.
I
kept a journal for a couple of years, actually, when I was in China.
Yeah, yeah.
And
interesting.
Before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I actually write with pad and pen and pencil as well. Or
and then you transcribe.
How
and then
retro! Transcribe. How retro of you.
You know why? Because there's more of an emotional bond. I know that might sound weird.
No,
when,
not at all.
When you're actually writing in a notebook, you like feel it more. Like if you're doing it at a computer, you're just typing it out. But if you're writing it out, you're consciously thinking about what you're putting down.
How about you, Neil? When you wrote your book, did you do it?
Strictly on computer, but because I'm not disciplined enough to do it. That, you know, I think it should be done the way you're both talking
right
here.
So you had to be near a computer.
And I have a laptop, so it's, I'm always had it with me everywhere.
Yeah.
But I think that my personal opinion is if you're going to start out, you should start with a pad and pencil and draw the book first. I don't mean draw as in illustrate.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean sketch out logically, almost like a flow chart a computer programmers would think.
Right,
flow chart this book as to where this, map it out is what I'm saying.
Exactly.
Where's this story or this history or this whatever it is? Where's it going to go? It has to. Every book has to have a beginning. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of a book, electronic or physical, that doesn't have a page one.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it has to have a concluding page. Mm-hmm. Where the whole thing is wrapped up.
Yeah. I'm trying to swing this, but I don't want to hijack this. But a lot of what you're saying here is similar to filmmaking, because filmmaking is also storytelling.
Yeah.
And you get storylines, and you map out the story.
Yeah. Disney is the one who invented the idea of storyboarding.
Mm-hmm, storyboarding. Mm-hmm.
And what a brilliant... I had opportunity to be trained in storyboarding a couple of times, by really great thinkers in this area, and storyboarding is just a brilliant thing to do. So yeah, so film. Well, see, I think you and I have said this, I think, in the podcast here before. I really think film is the literature of our times. Yeah. We talk films constantly. We talk videos. We talk TV shows.
Yeah.
These are stories. These are historical lines of thought, and. There's a logic to sketching the thing out before you start.
Yeah, but books. If you see a book that you love made into a movie, you may like the movie, but you're probably going to say, "I like the book better."
Yeah, I can only think of one instance where that wasn't the case.
And that was what?
Hunger Games. The movie was
Hunger
way better.
Games. Okay, interesting. Mm-hmm. And the book was significant, I think.
Yeah.
There was more than one book, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think it was three or four books. I only read part of the first one. I couldn't even finish it. It was just the writing style. Mm-hmm. I couldn't follow.
Interesting. So I have this idea. Sometimes when in the writing of a book, you shift gears, you shift directions. With this thing that's in my head for a book about my father... And my mother figures heavily into it because their story of them meeting and dating 2 weeks before he ships out for the war, and then all of those letters, I have all of these letters of his coming back from Europe, about 70 letters, and that's where really where I'm supposed to do something with this, I think.
Mm.
But knowing him as I did, he would have resented this no end. He's been gone. My dad's been gone for 22 years, and my mom's been gone for 19 years. Mm-hmm. But they still haunt me, and I can imagine my dad yelling at me, "How dare you write my story? Who do you think you are? That's inappropriate. I don't want my story told." Or I can just imagine this conversation.
Mm.
So I thought about doing it as a novel.
Yeah, and changing names.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
But let me.
But I don't know how to do that.
I think we did. I think we had this conversation.
Did we have this conversation? Is our podcast getting that old?
No. You mentioned about wanting to write a book for your dad, about your dad, and I encourage you to do it. And I will say it again. At least I think, unless I'm getting, you know, suffering from amnesia or some kind of thing, which is entirely possible. I want to encourage you to do that because there are a lot of people today who are growing up without a father.
Yeah.
And your dad lived in a time during history. He was part of that greatest generation.
Yep.
And made sacrifices and, not the perfect dad. I mean,
right.
but your respect for him, I think would resonate with a lot of people who are missing that fatherly figure.
That's an interesting observation. Because I could communicate a great sense of respect for him. And I also am the sort of person who's interested in multi-generational, in the families. His relationship with his father was not great, but it was better than the relationship that my grandfather had with his father four generations back.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's like this, we're improving over the generations, it seems. And yeah, I appreciate the encouragement on that. That is a thing that is done, I guess, was the point I was going to, is that sometimes people will pick fiction
mm-hmm.
because they either don't have the courage or there's some blocking thing to actually writing the history. And so they'll do a fictional element that has the historical backdrop to it. And that's a thing I've toyed with a little bit. I don't think I'm smart enough to actually write a novel, but it sure would be fun trying, you know.
I think you're smart enough.
Yeah, I do.
No, I don't think so.
I think you could do it.
It's something I think about. I read a book many years ago that I loved so much, and it was only a book, and it was published by Naval Institute Press, which is out of Annapolis. Whoever even heard of this publisher, right? And it was by an insurance man who was kind of a gun freak guy. And he wrote fiction just for kicks, basically. And he stumbled on this storyline that was really interesting. And the book was called The Hunt for Red October.
Mm-hmm.
And I read this book when I was working for the Navy. And I think he wrote it in maybe 76 or so, 1976 or so. And I took this book home. It was a hardback book, and I showed it to my father. And my father said, "That's an interesting story right there. Mm-hmm. Who is this guy?" Tom Clancy. Nobody ever heard of Tom Clancy. Yeah. Like I say, he was an insurance salesman. Must have been really bored with his actual occupation. And he gets home at night. You just can imagine this, and just loves writing and researching. He'd have Jane's warships, these big encyclopedia of naval stuff, and
first edition of that book sells for I remember years ago it was like $1,200 for a first edition of that book.
Isn't that something? Yeah,
I'm sure it's more now.
And then he went on from there and exploded into this incredible, and then he dies. He's dead now.
Yeah,
but his name is still all over the right. Tom Clancy tradition of stories. But anyway. So, both of you, let me ask you this question. What are you reading right now? Are you a reader?
Yes, I am a reader.
What are you reading right now, if you don't mind my asking? Or even if you do mind my
asking. I'm reading a young adult, fantasy romance called The Siren right now.
The author?
Kiara Cass.
Okay.
It's about a girl who, in the 1950s, her boat got it sunk at sea. Because sirens lured the ship down into the ocean, and she had to become a siren in order to survive. And it's your struggle, with living amongst land people and not being able to speak.
This is going back to the Greek mythology of the sirens. Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Odysseus or somebody, the great, the sea voyage, and the sirens would call them to. Is that what you mean by siren?
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, I love sea creatures.
You love what?
I love fantasy sea creatures like mermaids and sirens.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Wow. What are you reading right now?
The New Rules of Marketing and PR.
Is this a new book?
This is, it's new to me.
Okay.
But, I don't know.
And what's the author? Who's the author?
David Meerman Scott.
And that book that you're holding there is about 3 inches thick there, inches thick. Yeah. Is it interesting?
As interesting as new rules of marketing and PR. It's not. I'm not reading it for enjoyment. I'm reading it to learn something.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. But one question I don't see here is, and I'm not reading. I used to read for just entertainment until
video came out.
Netflix.
The bane of readers.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, my favorite book. Okay, my favorite fictional book is it's a small book, and I don't know why. I'm sure there are plenty of books that are better. This one just touched me, and to this day, and I've seen movies. The horrible movies. Two horrible movies were made about this book.
Oh, I know where this is going.
All right, Lost Horizon, James Hilton. You ever read the book?
James
Hilton.
Yes. And I don't remember why I read Lost Horizon. That's not about...
it's about Shangri-La.
Shangri-La.
And being lost...
That's not an old book.
No.
The 40s or 50s or
something? It was written in the late 30s, I think.
Yeah.
It was late 30s,
yeah.
Early
40s. No, for some reason I have read that book long ago now.
The book is fantastic. And I don't, not to ruin it for anybody, it's a story about this guy. He's a British diplomat, and he's in China, and they're evacuating because of a rebellion. The plane gets hijacked, and he's written some articles and about peace and things like that, and his plane gets hijacked, and the guy who hijacked it ends up taking him to the Himalayas, and they crash land, and the pilot is ancient, and all of a sudden these Sherpas come, and they take him down to this place in the valley where, it's in the Himalayas, the snow, but there's this beautiful valley protected by the mountains. It's called Shangri-La.
Utopian place.
Yeah. And while he's there, he discovers that the people who live there
are 300 years old or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he...
Wu is 180.
Yeah. And the story is so well crafted, and it just brings to mind so many questions about, what would you do if you were in Conrad? That's the guy, the character in his position. You know, he ends up leaving, then tries to get back after he leaves because his brother is with him and wants to, he's got to get out of there. You know, he just can't stand it. So for his brother, he sacrifices. He wants to stay there and ends up taking his brother out, but then tries to get back himself.
Classic story.
Yeah. And it's a really good book.
And I think, if I remember correctly, as you rehearse the basic plot, I think that was an important book, because I think a lot of science fiction has spun off of the influence of that and a few other books. You know, we would be criminally liable in this conversation if we didn't mention The Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
Because the story of the creation of The Lord of the Rings, of the writing of it, is really a cool story. And it's an odd story in that, Tolkien and Lewis and the other writers that were part Gale, I was going to say Gale Sayers. He's a Chicago Bear running back. Dorothy Sayer. And whoever else the other Inklings were, I can't remember.
C.S. Lewis was one.
Right? C.S. Lewis, yeah. They would sort of get around the table and have martinis together or whatever they drank. Yeah, do we have any martinis here today, by the way?
No.
I think we have some grog upstairs. Left over.
That's right, a little leftover grog from last night. So, but they would produce chapters and read them to each other and critique each other's writing, and they would be, I think, quite brutal.
Imagine. There's some similarities between Tolkien and Lewis if you've read all the books, and the scene with Galadriel when she shows Frodo the vision of what could be in the pool?
In the pool.
There's a similar scene, and I want to say it is in...
In the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah, I think it was The Horse and His Boy, where there was a very, very similar scene, and I'm like, ha-ha!
You can stole tell their that. Friends. Somebody stole it from somebody here. Yeah. Well, but the, you know that I'm a complete LOTR snob. I really am. I admit that right up front because I just have no use whatsoever for The Hobbit. We've discussed this before. We did a whole podcast on The Lord of the Rings, by
the
way.
We did.
If you remember correctly.
Was it just one?
I think it was just, maybe it was two. I think, anyway.
I don't think it was a long one
if it was just one. But I, not to rehearse that whole thing again or even slobber too much about the books themselves, but that is what really made me a reader.
Yeah.
It's the same with my dad.
I was in sophomore in high school, and a friend of mine threw this book at me, and it was called The Fellowship of the Ring, and I started into this thing, and I couldn't put it down. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not really, I had done some reading before that as a kid, but not a lot, yeah. And that hooked me.
Same with me, only it was The Hobbit.
Yeah.
We were reading.
Well, you're an idiot.
So yeah. That's,
My brother's read that book,
right.
I want to say,
shameful number of
times.
Yes, right. And he said that on this podcast, I think, in fact, yeah. When we had him on, but anyway, but just the writing of that story and one of the reasons so many people have not read it, it is so incredibly long. And the second book just goes on and on and on. I mean, you're trudging over those fields with, slag fields and Mordor with...
And Helm's Deep and all
it
that.
It just never ends. And mm-hmm. you feel weary just reading it, you know. But how long did Tolkien take to write the whole three books? Probably 30 years or something. Yeah. 25
I know
years?
They started off as letters to his son while he was at war, right?
World War One.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he finishes it at the after the end of World War Two, so it's many years that he takes in putting this together with mm-hmm. the help of his friends that they'd sit around and discuss dragons for hours, you know.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
Oh man, to sit down on that. To sit on, be a fly on the wall with those conversations. It'd probably be pretty boring, actually. But that's a way that books have been written sometimes, in more of an epic, almost, the writing of the book is a story of its own.
Yeah, that actually brings to mind something I'm working on right now. It's not a book. It's more like a couple of friends and I are actually creating a fictional universe where we're actually creating it together, but we're going to be telling stories from just different aspects of different characters. And it's really incredible. I'm really liking it so far.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, which gets us, and I think we'll close with this today because we've gone on a bit here, but the whole idea, and I think Bob, you and I have wrestled with this some in the podcast here. The whole idea of fantasy to begin with, for a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
One school of thought, the real hard-edged school of thought, I think would suggest we have no business fantasizing as Christians. We sort of take the scripture on a real blunt-edged application to our lives, and what are you doing fantasizing about anything? Isn't your faith, isn't the world of your faith and the hope you have in Christ enough? Why do you have to, Gabriel, go off and create a fictional universe? Why am I interested in Battlestar Galactica, which is precisely that? Or Star Wars. Let's not even touch the holy grail of Star Wars, right? In a galaxy long ago, blah, 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 far, far away. Why do we need this?
Because, first off, I think I brought this up, but John Bunyan was the first fantasy
you did
writer.
Say that.
Okay.
John Bunyan's a man.
So I can put it under the John Bunyan heading, my love of Battlestar Galactica.
That's sci-fi.
When you read science fiction or fantasy or just fiction in general, it gives you a window. It gives you a window to look in to see something that maybe you couldn't see that was right in front of you. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get involved in the story and then you can see. It's like wiping the window so you can see outside. Or see inside.
So going into a fantasy storyline helps me see reality
a little clearer.
Yes,
it
I agree.
It
heavy.
Could.
That's
okay.
Heavy.
And the other thing is that I forget what the other thing was. the other thing is that it entertains you and draws you in. Okay, not just to see it and understand it, but it actually draws you in. You could feel a connection with a character, or you know, and you see things from a different perspective, even.
Yeah.
So what you're
God created us to be creative. We're creative,
and that's a piece of who we are, right, as God has made us. And
now the danger is if that becomes your reality.
Yeah.
Okay.
When you start to cross boundaries of propriety.
Yeah.
You know, I myself, I think I've said this on the podcast before too, but I have no use for the macabre, for the dark. Now, there is dark in stories that I like, definitely. I have no problem at all with the dark side of the Force, the whole theology. But the dark side that is the waking dead, walking dead, you know, or stuff that fantasizes and imagines realities, imaginary realities that are directly contrary to what we're told to focus on as Christians.
Right.
Then, you know, and that would include everything that's sensually inappropriate to, and all of that. And yet, so there are boundaries and lines with fantasizing. I mean, I even use that word preaching sometimes. I fantasize about when Christ comes back.
Right.
Or when Christ comes. Or different themes related to eschatology. I have no problem at all fantasizing. People will look at me like, you're not allowed to fantasize. You should not use that word. And I'm going, it's called imagination, man, you know?
Exactly.
It's called projecting yourself into an imagined reality. You know, I do this in my prayer life, where I talk to the Lord about when I'm with him, I want to sit down and have a chat, if he'll allow me to, and I think he will. Or if, Lord, if you don't have time, which is stupid, because...
Because time never ends in heaven.
Yeah, and I don't think there is time, or something. It's just not a problem, whatever it is. Could I have some time? Would you send Paul over to sit down and give me 5 minutes?
Well, let me ask you...
Which, again, is stupid, because there's no 5 minutes.
I also agree with you about the occultic things. I really don't like that. Even when in The Hobbit or Silmarillion, where they talk about the necromancer and all that stuff.
Yeah,
it
makes you uncomfortable.
I don't like that.
Well, it makes the evil stronger, I think.
Yeah, but I don't like that stuff.
Yeah,
I have a healthy fear of that.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
I hear
you. Well, let me ask you a question. I knew a pastor who was writing a fictional book about Peter, the Apostle Peter.
Yep.
I don't know where he is on this. It's been a while. But and he was interjecting things in a fictional account about, who Peter's wife was, and who, you know, and wrapping these characters, given, you know, alluding to relationships that may or may not be, and, you know, and yet the gist of the thing, because I read a short portion of it when it could, you know, I don't know if he ever published it, but, you know, it was very interesting.
Yeah. It was.
Oh, yes.
But it wasn't necessarily the truth.
Right.
So what about stuff like that?
I have no problem with that. I think that if we have a framework, I can give you two examples that I think are excellent. One is the film. It was a miniseries in 1980. So that's quite a while ago now.
Peter and Paul, right?
Peter and Paul.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Anthony Hopkins, give me a break.
I actually saw a bit of that.
Huh?
I saw a bit of that when you recommended it years ago.
He is excellent. Yeah. He's an awesome Paul.
Yeah.
And Robert Foxworth is Peter,
who
is good. I'm believing this.
Yeah.
Foxworth also plays a Romulan, and I don't think he's a very good Romulan. But I don't like him as a Romulan at all. But, you know, these are accomplished actors,
seriously
laying out the Book of Acts. Mm-hmm. Peter and Paul, the movie, the miniseries, begins with Acts chapter 9, the stoning of Stephen, and goes down to their execution. So it's a 3-hour, I think, story, and it's fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that I'm listening to right now, which was loaned to me by somebody, is a dramatization of the life of Luke, and what, this is all speculative, because we really don't know the background at all of him writing his gospel or the Book of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
But this audio drama, which is really quite good, is him
going and collecting, doing the research. Mm-hmm. And all the troubles of the times and the danger he's in, he gets mugged, he gets beat up, he gets all these things that happen to him as he's trying to, because he's been, in the story, dispatched by a senator back in Rome who says, I want you to go and investigate this mm-hmm. legend we keep hearing about. And it's done by Focus on the Family, mm-hmm. and it's excellent. So if a story, unlike some of the other religious creations around the times of Jesus and the apostles, if a story takes the data of the Bible, mm-hmm. which isn't enough, we wished it was more, but we have what we have, the Gospels and Acts, basically, and whatever information in the epistles feeds back, mm-hmm. and uses that as the skeleton of the story you're writing, and then speculates and fills in, I have no problem with that at all. That's mm-hmm. exciting to me.
Yeah.
If it's well done.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you don't want to take it as gospel either.
And it's not gospel.
No.
Except the parts of it that are gospel.
Yeah. Right. But you know what? I've actually heard people like allude to something that they think is true because they saw it when Charles
right.
Weston was in Moses.
Yeah.
Like, that's right.
No. That's Hollywood. That's
right.
Hollywood.
Right. But that's a good example of, I learned probably more about the Book of Exodus by watching that movie after I got interested in the Book of Exodus. Mm-hmm. Because it plays out a lot of the history nicely in that movie. And then there are books. There's one called Priscilla that was a historical novel about mm-hmm. Priscilla and Aquila. Mm-hmm. And it's quite good. Now, we know very little about them.
Right.
But for some interesting reason, her name is placed first, more often than not, mm-hmm. in the Book of Acts. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, what's up with that? What's that mean? So this guy takes this story and makes her the more gifted of the two. Mm-hmm. Well, can we say that for sure? Well, no. But it's speculation. But mm-hmm. it's okay. It's all right. It stays within the boundary of respecting the scripture as revelation. So, all right. So we could say a lot more about writing books and so forth, but I think that's been a good introduction to the subject. Well, so you're going to be starting your book soon, Bob, then?
I thought about book, but I want to make a film. I want to make a documentary. I've had this documentary burning in my head for years and years and years, and I'm just trying to figure out how to translate that to.
On what subject? Are you willing to reveal what
it's
subject?
It's a historical piece of local history. It's about the first minister who was tried for murder, and it happened right in Fall River, Massachusetts, in Tiverton, Rhode Island.
You know, interesting.
At the time,
yeah.
It was Tiverton, Rhode Island.
You want to do a story on that? Yeah.
I want to do a story on it.
Yeah. That's fun.
But
it's not Mr. Lizzie Borden.
No.
Reverend Lizzie Borden.
His name was Reverend Ephraim Avery.
Yeah.
And the woman was Sarah Cornell. She was a mill worker, she was murdered right down at the bottom of Kennedy Park, the south end of Kennedy Park.
Interesting. And you'd like to do the story on that.
I would like to film that. I've got so many books on the subject. I even bought the court records.
We do get absorbed in our subjects of interest.
Exactly.
But outside of hiring actors and getting, period costume and stuff like that, which is really expensive,
right?
Or relying on drawings,
CGI.
It's
beyond your resources at this point. Well, that's a good dream, though. That's an excellent dream. Yeah. Okay, we've been on the podcast Coffee Break. You've been with us here a long time today, folks. I hope you're interested in the writing of books and the telling of stories, because we sure are, aren't we?
Oh, yeah.
We're going to close the book on this one.
We're going to close the book on this one. That's right, yeah. So I want to thank Bob Perrin from South Coast Multimedia and Gabrielle Perrin, his daughter. Yes.
Is this her first time on a podcast?
I think so. Caleb has been with us.
No, I did the Star Wars one.
Oh, you did?
Oh, that's right.
I was going to say we should inaugurate by letting me spray some coffee on
it. Yeah, that's right. Baptizer in coffee. Yeah, so we're glad you joined us, everybody. Interact with us in any way you want to. The easiest way is probably just by going through the Facebook page,
mm-hmm.
or email us, or go through iTunes, or we'd love feedback. And thanks for joining us.
And don't forget to buy Neil's book, The History of Dharma and Bible Church.
That's right.